This is Profiles in Risk. Hosted by Nick Lamparelli. Every week, we interview those who risk life, limb, fortunes, career, and reputation, and those who work behind the scenes who look to protect and enlighten us about risk. You can find the show notes and other insurance-related content at insnerds.com. That's insnerds.com. Now, on to the show.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to Profiles in Risk. This is a special edition of Profiles in Risk. As you can see, we have the gang here. Tony and Carly are my co-hosts. Tony, hello. Carly, it's always great to have you here. It's got to be a special occasion if Carly's here. The purpose of this particular podcast, which is also a video, so if you're listening to this, go on YouTube and catch this and see all of our pretty faces, is to talk to Bill Wilson. Bill has been on Profiles in Risk a couple times. He's the founder and CEO of Insurance Commentary, 50-year veteran of the insurance war, is a sought-after speaker, policy interpreter, court witness, and author. And we are having him on this special episode of Profiles in Risk to discuss his new book, When Words Collide, Resolving Insurance Coverage and Claims Disputes. When Bill isn't writing or speaking about insurance, he is a musician living in the capital of music, Nashville, Tennessee. Bill, with the halo, welcome to Profiles in Risk.
Great. Hey, ENS nerds. Thanks for having me.
Bill, we're all looking forward to the book. Carly has been doing the editing on that. Tony has read it. I've seen bits and pieces of it, and they are ecstatic in praise for the book. So I want to start off by asking you, what was the purpose of you writing the book?
Well, I'm about to turn 67, so I had to leave something behind when my time comes. And this represents at least 30 years of my life. So it begins, and I tell the story in the book. There's an early chapter of how this really started with the seminar that I put together with one of my mentors, John Eubank, who passed away last year. And at the time we did the seminar, I thought at that time this could become a book sometime. So I've thought about it for 30 years, and I've basically been accumulating what is now the book for those 30 years. So that was the idea, that initially it was a face-to-face thing, and I just couldn't reach enough people. When you're doing it in the seminar, we'd do it for 20 people, or occasionally it might be 200 or 300 people, but I just couldn't reach the people that I thought would benefit from my story, from what I had to tell.
That is one thing we learned with our own book, that the number of people you can reach with a book is incredible. And, you know, it's really old technology, but it really works, right?
Yeah.
You sell a few thousand copies. How many years would it take you to reach a few thousand people with that message?
Yeah.
And the audience can read the book. Yeah, the audience that can read the book is much broader, right? It's much easier to get a copy of that in your hands than it is to try to get to a conference. And we talk a lot at Insurance Nerds about the importance of educating younger and newer insurance professionals. So we are thrilled to have the benefit of Bill and John's years of experience and share that through the book. We're really excited about it.
Bill, when I meet with younger people and I'm giving career advice, I always talk about how you know you're in what you're supposed to be doing when you start to expect excellence in what it is that you do. And just as you were describing that, all I kept thinking about was insurance was your art form. And which is, I think a lot of folks that are younger or outside of insurance would think that's strange because it's insurance. So, you know, insurance is boring, but, you know, it's an important occupation, and you got into it at such a fine level that it essentially became your art. And I think this book is essentially like a piece of artwork that captures 30 years of all of the nuance that you dealt with on a day-to-day basis.
Yeah, it's, I mean, I started out as an engineer. I'm like 99% of the people in the industry. I never had any idea I was going to be involved in any way with insurance. So I got a degree in engineering, and specifically in fire protection, started working in the insurance industry. And when I worked on my CPCU, I just got hooked on the coverage side of it. To me, it's like Chris Amrine. This thing is insurance is fun. It's fun. The whole idea of a claim and whether it's covered or not is like going on a scavenger hunt or something, using an insurance policy. And it's not for everybody. I mean, you think about millennials today and encouraging them to get into this side of the industry. It's the same issue with people my age. Not everybody is focused on that aspect of it. But, I mean, that's everything we do boils down to the insurance contract. That's what it's all about. Everything we do, from selling and underwriting and claims adjusting, everything boils down to people have losses. They look to an insurance contract, and that's where you determine where the rubber meets the road. That's where it all centers on. So I've always been fascinated by that, and by taking a claim scenario or a coverage question and trying to decipher the solution or the resolution of a dispute from an insurance contract. And it's fun for me anyway.
What I am most excited about is that I believe that this is a true solution to the transferring the knowledge down, basically. This is like grabbing several thousand younger insurance professionals and having Bill mentor them on the depths of policy language. And, you know, we don't have enough bills to do that. And the industry is not very good at that kind of mentoring. And it's really funny. This really old technology of a book allows us to help that knowledge carry down forever. And I hope that it inspires many other of the stalwarts of the industry as they retire to follow suit and do the same.
And Tony just mentioned mentoring. And I was just going to say before that, one of my favorite things about the book is that you share stories from your career. And it does all boil down to the insurance contract. But the fun part is, in addition to going on that scavenger hunt in the policy, meeting with people, hearing their stories, getting to connect with them, and then helping them solve these issues that they're having, right, Bill?
I've spent 30 years working mainly in helping agents get claims covered that they thought were covered that maybe were denied initially. And again, that's the true test of the insurance product, is whether it actually covers what people hope and think that it covers. So it's greatly frustrating for agents when they're almost positive that something's covered and they can't convince the adjuster. So what I've tried to do is take all of the tricks of the trade, the things that I've used, the principles, the practices, the procedures that have worked. I think I use a figure of over 90%. I don't have any hard data for that, but I just have a feeling that over 90% of the time we've been able to convince an adjuster to change their mind about coverage by applying certain principles that I talk about in the book. And there is an agent and a policyholder focus here, because as I point out about 50 times in the book, the purpose of insurance is to insure. So you're always looking for coverage. It's not always there, and you didn't always pay for it, but that's what you look for. But by the same token, I'm hoping the book works for people that are on the other side from the claim standpoint, that they'll, you know, make a decision by looking at the book and some of the principles and practices in it, and that it'll benefit them and benefit attorneys and anyone involved in the dispute process.
You mentioned that it is sort of focused towards agents and policyholders, but you do cover something that I've been thinking about a lot as I'm reading it, is that there can be an adversarial relationship between carrier and agent, but there really, we should try to overcome that, because adjusters are at good companies trained to look for coverage. And that is what you're hoping to do with the policy. You're looking for a way to cover someone unless it truly is excluded.
And I think most adjusters do that. There are always exceptions, and there are exceptions for different reasons, but I think most do the job they're supposed to. They're looking for coverage, but sometimes it's not clear whether there's coverage or not. So the point of the book is a structured process to try to determine what is a fair resolution. And it doesn't always go in the insured's favor, but the idea is to try to do the right thing.
I love that. I love that it's an honest book. And you make it very clear throughout the book that in your experience, 90% of claims are paid fairly. So this is not a how to get your claim paid when it shouldn't be. This is a guide for both sides on how to fairly handle claims. And also, I'm the least technical of the group. Even though I'm a CPCU, I'm really the least policy language deep. And not only did I learn a lot in your book, which I knew I would learn a lot, but I thought that it would be an effort to get through it because it's technical. It's a really funny read. It really is. I've got notes all over where I've really got, I noted where it literally made me laugh out loud.
That makes me think, I mean, Bill, you talked about how it's 30 years worth of your work. How much of that was pure memory? Like, or how much, you know, did you have notes? How did you do the research to capture 30 years? That's a long time and a lot of information to kind of process through.
Yeah, it wasn't, some of it was memory, but a lot of it were claims or coverage issues that I've been talking about in seminars for years. So some of the examples I've had, I've done dozens and dozens of times. So I had those ingrained, but I've saved articles that I've written for all kinds of publications and seminar materials. And I'm old school. I printed everything out. It's the way I've always done it. So I printed everything out. And I was telling my friend who was here this weekend, an agent from Missouri that did a really great review of the book for me and pointed out some things. I showed him on my desk where I had stacks of, I would say I had at least 8 stacks that averaged 1.5 to 2 feet high of documents that went back to the 1990s. And I went through all of that stuff again. I've been doing this for the last year to put this together. And I followed kind of the original seminar. I kind of followed the format, but most of what I've got here, probably most of it is stuff that I've not really talked about in depth, which you can't do when you've got a 1 hour or 2 hour, maybe a 3 hour seminar. You can't go into potentially several hundred pages of content in that time slot. So I've added a lot of stuff that I've never told people about, but I've used a lot of examples that I found over the years work, that it takes a difficult policy provision, and by using a real life example that actually happened, it's kind of a light bulb moment for a lot of people. They get it once I give them this example of how that policy provision works.
Any favorite stories? Anything in particular that rings out as one of your favorites in the book?
I do talk about a guy who worked at the Tennessee Insurance Department, Dick Weber, and he was instrumental as one of when I get into the step by step process for resolving claims. At one point in the process that you may get to is getting assistance from your state insurance department, and this guy was invaluable many times in helping me resolve disputes. So I tell a couple of stories about Dick Weber, maybe one of my favorites, and the most difficult claim I was probably ever involved with was a lady who sold about a $29,000 diamond ring through the online marketplace?
eBay?
Craigslist.
And she got ripped off. Guy gave her a false cashier's check. And so I won't go into the sordid details, but we ended up getting the claim paid, and we had to take the final step in the process, which was to seek the aid of an attorney. Doesn't mean you have to litigate it. You just have to find, and we found an attorney who was a billionaire attorney, big-name attorney. His office, I'm sure it wasn't him, but his office wrote a letter, and bam, 3 days later, she got a check for $29,000. So sometimes it takes that, but the vast majority of time I show how you can do it a lot easier than that. But that whole story, I go into detail there about it's a long involved thing about who the insured happened to be and how this all played out. So that probably my favorite claim of all time, even though it was the most frustrating.
Do you have the shirt available right next to you?
I do.
Can you show the shirt? Good. RTFP. We actually had Carly, yourself, Tony, and me had a conversation about that online, discussing that. What does RTFP mean?
Well, I reveal that in the book.
Okay.
RTFP, I'll give you part of it, stands for Read the Policy. The book goes into a little bit more detail about...
So why is that important? Can you, of course, it's like read the policy, but why are we stressing that? I mean, that's really like the essence of your book, but why is that so important?
Because people don't read the policy. It's amazing. We know insureds don't read it. You'd be amazed at how many agents don't read it. What's that?
Adjusters don't read it. Underwriters don't read it.
Yeah.
I know Carly's horrified, right? But I'll be honest. I've read one policy in my entire career, and that's because that's part of the training. They had me read it. But every other job, and I've had like 8 insurance jobs in claims, in underwriting, in different areas, and they just never told me to read the policy. And it's not a fun read. So, right? And I think that's the case with most younger insurance professionals. We were never trained to read the policy.
So I worked on helping a training class get improved in my last role. And there were discussions around, do we need to keep having our new underwriters read the policy? And it was very interesting to hear the different kind of how long people have been at the company. They've gone through different training programs. Some people were forced to read it. Some people were not. And everyone thought that they were fine if they hadn't. And it does horrify me. I don't understand how you can interpret what you're selling if you don't read it. So from an underwriting perspective or an agent's perspective, it's just crazy to me that you would sell something that you haven't read. And I can't imagine how much more frustrated Bill feels.
Well, it helps when you're reading the policy, hopefully the way that I've written the book, that there are examples all the way through it. Mm-hmm. And they're real examples. They're not, you know, Bob and Jane, blah, 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 blah. They're real people and real things that actually happen. So when you take it in little pieces and then apply mm-hmm. it as you go along, it makes it so much easier. Just sitting and reading a policy, there's not a lot interesting about that unless you're doing it because you're looking for something. And it's that coverage question or that claim scenario that starts the search, the scavenger hunt through the policy. And that's the only thing that makes it interesting. But it's, you know, not everything we do in our careers is just a barrel of laughs. Some things are tough to do, but you have to do them because
that's right.
Everything goes back to this contract. You know, you help insureds identify their exposures, and you know, unless you know what products you're selling cover those exposures, you don't know what to sell them, and you sell them something you don't know whether it really impacts what they're doing or not. So
you make a pricing decision that doesn't make sense because you don't understand what exposures you're looking to cover, or there's all sorts of things that can go wrong on both sides.
Or you think they're all the same, which is the way most consumers mm-hmm. do because of industry advertising. You think the only thing that's different is that price. So it doesn't really matter.
Right.
An auto policy is an auto policy. And the differences are dramatic and catastrophic. And we just, it bothers me immensely that we have ingrained that into the consumer's mind that's, it's just a commodity. There's no difference between it. If you're comparing one policy and you're looking at the same liability limits, the same collision deductibles and all that, then everything else is the same and nothing could be further from the truth. And I give, in the book, I give a lot of examples of some of those differences.
I think it gets worse. I think it's worse than that. So Carly mentioned pricing. So if you put yourself in the shoes of a product developer, a product designer, because a lot of these folks have not read the policy, their knee-jerk reaction is, let's take what we already have and we'll just add some bells and whistles to it. And it's part of the lack of innovation in the industry is nobody knows. Bill, this is from my experience because I've now worked with several companies. No one actually knows how to write a policy. And so it's amazing when a reinsurer comes to me and says, if you want to write it, go ahead. We can give you some guidance. But no one wanted to touch it because no one actually wanted to write the policy. So the knee-jerk reaction is just use what's always been used.
Yeah. It's an art and a science to some extent. I'm looking at part of my insurance library here. I'm going to grab a book and give a plug to Ermi. This is a book. It was originally written by a guy named Ken Wolner. And Ken passed away several years ago, and Ermi bought the rights to the book, and they revised it and published it. It's called How to Draft and Interpret Insurance Policies, and I plugged this in the book. For people that actually write insurance policies, they need a copy of this, and anybody who really wants to be an expert at their craft needs a copy as well.
I'm going to put that in the show notes, so anyone that's listening or watching will have a link to that. I have the Institute's old book on drafting insurance contracts. I'll mute my phone and grab it. Yeah, it's an old one, but I'll look that one up, Bill. I had an interesting back and forth on, I think it was Twitter. That's the one. Yeah. That's the one. I'll pull mine up as well. Mine's right behind me. I had an interesting back and forth on Twitter with some InsurTech folks, and we were talking about policies. And I felt like the curmudgeon in the group. You know, I was the one that was just, you know, they're just like, you know what's wrong with the insurance industry is you got these complicated policy languages, you know, the policy forms, you can't understand them. And I felt like an idiot being the sane person in the room saying, do you think it's the insurance company it themselves that caused the complication in the policy forms? Or do you think it's like years and years of legal cases? You think you can just simply come in and write a simple policy language without lawyers from the other side coming in to tear it apart? So Bill, could you walk the audience through from a new product to a new policy? How does it evolve to complicated, where you need an expert with 30 years like you to come in and say, yeah, there's coverage or there's no coverage?
It's you're right in that it starts with something that's been used for years and years, and they massage it and they change things here and they add things and so forth. And the reason is you mentioned that there's one viewpoint that the carriers may overcomplicate policies on purpose. And there's actually a doctrine, I forget the name of it, I think I mentioned it in the book. It's held often by policyholder attorneys that it's complicated on purpose so that people are confused, or you can use different interpretations with different people in different claim scenarios or whatever. And I don't believe that at all. It's in everybody's interest to have these as simple and as understandable as possible. But the reality is the extensive litigation. That's what I think a lot of the new InsurTech folks don't realize, is how often this stuff is litigated, and not most of it never reaches the court, reaches the trial level, but it reaches the lawyer level. And it's you have to be an expert. That's why I pointed to the Ermi book. There is an art and a science to drafting an insurance contract. And part of it is contract law. They're all vetted by attorneys. The best insurance contract writers are ISO, Insurance Services Office. And they've been doing it for their predecessors for, you know, over 100 years. And I encourage, when I've done seminars with a lot of people, and particularly company people, I've encouraged them to work with ISO to draft their policy forms, even if they want to develop their own forms or a variation of ISO forms, to work with the people that really understand them. But it's essentially that the courts have determined what the terms mean. So anytime there's a filing where ISO is changing the language, they are incurring a risk And I give a great example in the book of where in the personal auto policy, there's the public or livery conveyance exclusion. Nobody talks about livery vehicles. And that's, you'll see that on old Gunsmoke TV shows where Muley ran the livery stable. That's where you haul stuff around on wagons with horses. So they tried to modernize the wording, and what happened was it was immediately misinterpreted by the people that were applying the policies, adjusters. So they end up going back to the old language because there were thousands of court cases. Everybody knew and agreed, to some extent anyway, what livery was and what the exclusion applied to. And the new language, everybody was making up new rules about it. So sometimes you keep the language maybe a little antiquated or a little complex because the courts have determined that that language has a certain meaning. And if it's litigated again, they're going to reach the same conclusions.
You point out in the book that even companies that subscribe to ISO don't immediately adopt the forms. And that brought me right back to my job at American Modern. Their forms are ISO, their ISO forms from the late 80s. I want to say 1988, but that might not be the exact year. Why is that? Why do companies take so long to adopt new language once ISO puts it out?
Well, I guess the main reason is what I was saying. They're familiar with it. They're people who've been trained on that language. They understand the court cases involving the language. That in the past several years, I've been with two different personal lines carriers. Both are major national companies, well-known companies. One of them was using the 1991 ISO homeowners program. The other was using the 2011 version. So the one company, a very big, well-known company, is using a version that's 20-something years old, but they're satisfied with it. And often what they'll do is they'll stick with the old edition and they'll develop their own endorsements. This company had the 1991 ISO homeowners forms, and then they added a broadening endorsement that I had bought. So they'll stick with the language they're familiar with and they understand, the people are trained on, and then they may add something to that.
Bill, is there a particular line of business, commercial, homeowners, auto, where you find that the policy language is more confusing than the others?
Probably in business income. Pretty much nobody understands that. And even accountants don't understand it. What it covers is very esoteric. You know, business income is a defined term, and it depends on whether you're a manufacturer, wholesaler, whatever, how you determine business income. So the language can be very difficult to understand, but I find that the most complex policies and the ones often litigated are the broadest. The broader the coverage, probably the more complexity there is. People think of the personal auto policy as being a very simple, like ISO's form is 14 pages or something. And give or take a couple of pages, not a big policy, but the coverage is so broad that the terminology can be broadly interpreted one way or another. And you've got to have some exclusions, or if it covers everything, then it becomes unaffordable. So it becomes very difficult to determine what is and isn't excluded the broader the coverage grant. If you have a policy with five named perils, well, that's pretty easy to know whether fire, lightning, aircraft, or whatever is or isn't covered. But when you have everything is covered except these eight pages of exclusions, it gets much more complex.
Yeah, I noticed that with myself working on the flood side, just the struggling with the definition of flood. And once we got to a definition, we immediately ran to exclusions because we started to realize, well, there's a whole bunch of other types of water damage that can occur, and we're going to have to exclude those. So how do we word that correctly? It is an art. It's very complicated because we're pricing this under a certain set of assumptions, and we have to make sure those assumptions hold. And so if other types of losses are leaking in and we haven't taken that into consideration, our pricing's wrong. and we're going to take it on the chin. Plus, we want to make sure that a court feels that the way that we worded it is matches our intention as well and is not broadly covered. I've seen a bunch of cases where claimants would go in and want coverage, and the definition of flood just keeps expanding and expanding to, you know, pretty much anything that covers water damage. A lot of it is the lawyers on the other side. That's what they get paid for, is to punch holes into the policy and try to get coverage.
Exactly. You know, pollution is probably the best example. Nobody knows what a pollutant is. It varies in every state. It can be in one state, it was milk. A milk truck overturned into a trout ranch pond and killed the fish, and they denied it with the pollution exclusion in the business auto policy, and in that case, the court upheld it. In another state, they would consider that to be a ridiculous application of the exclusion, that it's only environmental-type pollution, like, you know, gasoline storage tanks leaking and so forth. So it depends. You can have exactly the same policy provision, and it's covered in one state and it's not covered in another state. And you're right. That's when I've gotten pushback from agents about, well, you're nitpicking the coverage. Well, that's exactly what happens in a trial. The lawyer that's trying to find coverage is going to look, as you say, for every hole in the policy they can find. And the idea is to try to identify that up front and plug it before you get to that stage.
And you want to do that so that you don't end up being underpriced and being unable to pay claims for claimants.
Exactly, yeah.
Are buying what they think they're buying.
Yeah. I mean, companies are willing to pay claims as long as they get the premium that covers them. So if they, mm-hmm. if there are unintended consequences, I had one of the examples I give in the book is a filing that ISO made where they changed the wording very minutely in their special causes of loss commercial property form. And they had unintended consequences. They didn't completely think through all the ramifications of all the possible claims that could happen. And it's hard to do. So when I worked for the Big I, we had a technical affairs committee. We met at ISO headquarters every year. And we pointed that out to them, and they admitted it. Well, we made a mistake on this. And when we do our next countrywide revision, we'll fix that language, and they did. They were true to their word, and they're as good as it gets when it comes to writing policy forms. So, but they're not infallible. And you can imagine when you have a lot of carriers, particularly in the E&S marketplace, writing their own policy forms. I've seen some bizarre things in the marketplace that nobody even understands what they're trying to cover or not cover. So, to me, again, that's why it's so fascinating trying to apply all these different policy forms to claims.
I mean, we're talking about commas, right?
Yeah.
I mean, that's a classic case last year where the Oxford comma, I think it was a $10 million claim that ended up getting paid because the insurance policy was missing a comma, and that comma, according to the
it's gonna make Tony cry.
It changed the sentence, missing that comma.
Yeah. Yeah, I give an example in the book of back in my ISO days, I interviewed for a home office job, and one of the division managers, referred to me as the semicolon guy, because I had found a should have been a semicolon, and it was a comma, or vice versa, I forget off the top of my head. But it made all the difference in whether that exclusion yeah. applied or not. So it does matter. I mean, I hate to say that, but it does. There are lots of court cases. I think I cite several of them in the book where it comes down to punctuation. Yeah. You'll see that ISO uses a lot of lists where instead of having a string of things separated by commas, they'll do A, B, C, D, et cetera. And that's one of the techniques of getting around it.
If you're a professional, young or old, I don't know if Tony Accarly, are you guys familiar with Rough Notes?
Mm-hmm. I know what it is, and actually we are friends with their executive editor. Mm-hmm. So I won't badmouth Rough Notes. Yeah. I know that they're very, very, very old. They've had some trouble adjusting to the digital age, but I definitely know who they are.
That might be the case, but young or old, since I was an agent my first few days in my career, at the beginning of Rough Notes, the very beginning of the magazine, they have court cases. And it is the best read. Like, if you want to train yourself, one, buy Bill Wilson's book, but two, I think Rough Notes is free. I think you can just sign up for it online and get it delivered to your house. And they have actual court cases where they walk through what happened and what was litigated and how it progressed through the court system and what was the, most of the time they have ultimately how the case ended. And you really learn a lot about like how complicated these things are. Let's build to your point, like punctuation. It matters, and an astute lawyer can get paid a lot of money by going in and saying, there should have been a comma there. I think you have coverage. We're going to file suit.
Yeah, one of the examples I give in the book is a claim that we got paid, and how we got it paid was by stressing the tense of the verb that was in the exclusion. It didn't match up with the denial, and they admitted it and ended up paying the claim. That I think the intent of the policy was probably not to cover what happened, but it when you read the policy, it covered it because of the tense of that verb. So the idea is if you pay the claim because it's covered through a literal reading of the policy, then you go back and revise the contract wording. How it should work.
One of the things that I found fascinating, and I think that this book will pay for itself many, many times for all who buy it, but the how to look at other policies. So for example, if this is a named peril, or this is an open peril, and they're saying it's not covered, but it's clearly covered in the inferior named peril version. I thought that was just brilliant. I had no idea that was a way to clarify, using the other policy to clarify what one policy means and not the other. And it's just chock full of incredible tips like that I don't know about Carly, but we were just not trained on it when I came into the industry.
Okay.
So we could obviously talk about policy language and keep going about Bill's book and how fantastic it is. But we do have a couple questions for you, Bill, about a little bit about the process that you've gone through with us. We wanted to ask first why you chose to publish it with InsuranceNerds.
Well, I mentioned at the outset that I had, when we did John and I did the first real seminar on this topic, I had the idea for a book, and I actually did a seminar, I think it was at a CPCU convention, and I mentioned that one day I wanted to write a book and take all of this and a whole lot of other stuff and put it in a book format. Well, there was somebody there from a major industry publisher who gave me his card and said he was real interested in publishing it. But that was quite a while ago, and I was busy doing other things, and nothing ever happened. And then when I started to retire and I could devote time to writing this, I mentioned what I was doing to another major publisher, and he was very interested. But one of the issues was, if you look at what insurance books cost, one of my favorite insurance authors is an attorney in Philadelphia named Randy Maniloff, and Randy is an excellent insurance defense attorney, and he's one of the funniest people I've ever met. He does stand up comedy as a hobby, and he has a book. I've got it here on my shelf. It's the General Liability Insurance Coverage book. It's about different states and case law and so forth. Anyway, it's $250, and it's worth every penny of it, particularly if you're an attorney. It's a great book, but it's $250. So I talked to a publisher, and he was thinking that this book should be priced probably in the $100 to $150 range. And I said, nobody will buy it. I mean, the whole idea is I'm putting 30 years of my life into this thing. I want people to read it. I think I have something to say. I think I have something to say that will be immensely helpful to them and to their customers. And to the other side too, to adjusters and attorneys and so forth. But so I wanted, I know in talking to you guys, you were more reasonable about pricing this, not to try to make a lot of money, because insurance books don't make a lot of money, but to get the there. So, you know, hopefully we'll sell this for 25 cents a copy, though I doubt that we can hit that number, but it's more affordable. And I admired your enthusiasm, and it's fun working with younger people because you get all excited about stuff, and people my age don't get excited about much of anything. So those are a couple of the reasons.
I like being called young.
Yeah, well, from my perspective, yeah.
So, Bill, I think it's important, you know, you were very introspective, you know, wanting to express yourself in this way. You know, everybody knows that we are really focused on the talent gap. So, you know, there are a lot of very experienced people that will be retiring in the next 10 years. They're going to be taking that wisdom out of the marketplace. How do we convince them to do what you did and to get that wisdom into their art form, which, you know, book or video or whatever?
Well, that you know, that's probably something I need to get to work on. I know the people you're talking about, and they have, like you say, they have everything up here, and it's going to go when they go. They don't leave. They'll leave articles or something like that, but I know a consultant that lives not far from me by the name of Jim McCurran, and Jim is a brilliant guy that knows an awful lot about risk management, and he really needs to write something. So I'm going to do a better job of encouraging these people to leave some kind of a legacy behind. If you've been to my website, I dedicate it to the late, great Don Malecki and to his legacy and to who he was. Yeah, who was one of he and Eric Wining were the two authors of that book. Eric was one of the reviewers of this book, in fact, a former Institute guy, really sharp guy. One of the things that Don did was he left a huge body of work of his newsletter and articles that he wrote for, I forget how many years. I'm trying to get some of these guys. I'm going to try to get some of these guys to put things into writing. I've got some ideas to build on this book, and I may try to find some co-authors. I've got another guy who has contacted me not long ago about writing a book. So maybe
keep you guys busy. We've been talking about that as we start to wrap up the editing of this book. I've been doing the bulk amount of editing. Tony's been doing a lot on the sales and marketing. We were really lucky that you reached out to us, and it's been a pleasure reading your work, and you've been on schedule, haven't had to prod you at all. And so we're seeing this as a really great success and recognizing that not everyone has spent time writing the way that you have in the past. So as we think about who else can we get to write for us, and for us, I mean our audience and people in our generation who are looking for this kind of knowledge and looking for it in a sustainable, easy way to get it, we're excited to start helping the next set of authors and recognizing that there may be some more work involved in that. So, you know, we are open to a challenge, and this first experience has been just wonderful because your book has turned out beautifully. And that's all because of the work that you've put into it.
Well, we'll see how many people buy this thing. But the, you know, one of my goals was to write something different from other insurance books. There, you know, there's mm-hmm. some great books out there. The institutes have a whole library full of books, and they're terrific books, but I wanted to do something that was readable, that you would sit and turn the page and sit and read it and not just be bored to tears by a bunch of policy language and stuff. So I've tried to inject humor. I've tried to tell stories. I've tried to make it something that people will sit down over a period of time, read from cover to cover, and then in the coming years, keep the thing and dog ear it and make notes and use it as a reference later on. So hopefully maybe that's the key, is making something that's readable and interesting. We'll find out.
It is well beyond readable. It is enjoyable. It honestly, if you work in the industry, that's really the only requirement. You'll enjoy this book. You don't have to be deeply technical to get into it.
Okay, well, let's wrap this up with pre-orders. How people that are listening, Tony, how can they pre-order or get the discount code? Where can they go?
Okay, so we don't have a domain name yet. We need to talk about that. But the easiest way to find it right now is on our website, on the Insurance Nerds website, insnerds.com. There, what used to be in the menu, it used to be the Insuring Tomorrow tab. Now says books. And underneath, you have both Insuring Tomorrow and When Words Collide. So basically, go to insnerds.com, click on books in the menu, and then click on When Words Collide. And for
or
now,
the show notes.
You can.
Or the show notes, exactly. Or I will spell it out for you, insnerds.com/when-words-collide.
Collide.
There you go.
And there,
you can get the discount for the book.
Exactly. There you can click a button, put your email address in, and you'll immediately get the I'm very proud that this is automated, by the way. You immediately get a discount code, which gets you $5 off when it comes out.
Wait a second.
And,
if the book is 25 cents, does that mean they get money back? How does that work? Okay.
We weren't quite able to hit the 25 cents price point, but this is affordable. This is in the price range with our other book. It'll be affordable for anybody in the industry. That is exactly what Bill wanted, and we agreed wholeheartedly with him.
Do you want to share the price?
Yes. So retail price is $24.99. So with the $5 off, you end up at $19.99. So literally, it's an affordable read. I spent years of my life at Nationwide saying that the biggest thing I could do for the company was getting a bunch of people started on CPCU. I feel the same way. I think that the biggest thing that we can do for this industry is getting people like Bill to write their book and then getting it into as many hands as possible. Because it's like getting them mentored by some of the brightest minds of our industry.
We have talked a lot about call centers and customer service reps and claims reps. Just imagine if this was on your desk your first day of work. It's going to really excite you about the claims calls that are coming in. You're going to see what kind of a career you can grow into. I am just really excited to see how many hands we can get this into, because it is, it can truly help you grow your passion about what you're doing.
Mm-hmm. By the way,
read this thing. Go to your next interview. Go ahead, Bill.
One of my reviewers is an agent. And he represents a regional company, a very progressive and very agent-focused regional company. And he's determined that he is going to convince them to, if we can brand the book for them, that they will buy a copy for every underwriter and adjuster and every one of their agents and give it to them. So I told him we would be happy to work with them on that.
Absolutely.
As the marketing guy, there is no if on that. We can absolutely do that. We can do that on day one. So after you read and love this book, if you've got an agency force or if you've got a claim adjuster force or an underwriter force that would benefit from the book and you'd love for them to have a copy with your logo on page one printed right into the book, we can do that in a matter of a couple of days. So it's the beauty of a fully digital process.
It's like... can't say it better than that. The name of the book is When Words Collide. Bill Wilson, this is going to be exciting. The book's going to come out in May, and thrilled to have it, thrilled to be able to preach your art, sell your art to the world. Thank you so much for coming on again, and thank you so much for writing this book.
Thanks. Enjoyed it.
Carly, Tony.
Thank you, Nick.
Take care, everyone.
Thank you.